All right, so we're going to go through the wedding ceremony now. And as going on, you have questions, comments, please just kind of, for a small group tonight, to just hit me up with whatever you want to know. So what I have here is a very handy tool. This two-page document will really be a lifesaver. It just reminds you what to make sure you have, you need, and kind of help you plan out the wedding itself. Just so you don't forget anything. So this I found is a kind of very useful tool, and I use it all the time. Okay, but we're going to go through it, and then as we go through the ceremony, we'll kind of refer back to this sheet as it's happening. Now, first, a few things leading up to the wedding. So let's talk about, number one, the halachic prenup. This is very, very important. So obviously we all know the issue of agunot, of women that are not able to remarry because their husbands don't give a get. So the best tool we have at our disposal as a community is something called the halachic prenuptial agreement, okay, which I have here in my hand, and I want everyone to get a chance to look over. This is the English one. Well, they're all in English pretty much. So this is as follows. It is a contract that's been approved by a whole legal team that punishes the husband for every day that he, basically they have a civil agreement, but he doesn't give a get or tries to use it for custody battle or whatever it is. He is fined a certain amount every day, and it is legal and is held up in court. It creates a disincentive from trying to play those games. Now, obviously, no one thinks they're going to need this when they get married. But if everyone does it, that will make sure that those who will need it will have done it as well. And so, to a certain extent, everyone taking on the responsibility to sign one of these beforehand helps those that will need that help later on. And it just nips potential problems in the bud, and we don't hear about those agunos because they sign these in advance. So, I strongly recommend to please, please, please sign one of those. If your Masada condition should bring it up, if he doesn't, bring it up with him. Say, I want to sign one of these. It's important to me. This is the way we help agunot, is by every couple signing one of these before they get married. So, you can look it over, but that's important. Point number one. Okay. Let's discuss some of the customs that happen kind of leading into the wedding. Obviously, you have the Ufruf, which is typically the Shabbos before, but sometimes it can be a week before as well, certainly if the wedding is not in their home location. Often people want to do an Ufruf where they grew up, the community they live in now, and then they go off to the wedding site. So you can do it a week, So I've seen even 2 weeks before, but mostly either a week before the Shabbos, right before the wedding. The Ufruf doesn't have to entail very much. It's really an aliyah. Often the chassan does the half Torah as well. And maybe they sponsor a kiddush. It's kind of a nice way to bring the Torah in. And part of the idea is that by being called to the Torah, it's reminding them that the point of the marriage is to help bring Torah into their lives as well. So you want to bring the chassan to the Torah before the wedding to remind them that that's really what this is all about. Now, there is a custom to fast the day of the wedding. So let's talk about that right now. First, some reasons why we have this custom. Now, like many customs I'm going to talk about tonight, it's a predominantly Ashkenazi custom. Ashkenazim have a lot more random customs than Sephardim. The Sephardim certainly have their customs as well, but Ashkenazim have a lot of customs that the Sephardim never took upon themselves. This is one of them. Fasting. So why do we fast? So a few reasons that are given. Number one, this is a theme that we'll discuss throughout, is that we treat the wedding day as a personal Yom Kippur for the chassan and the kala. That for this couple, the Gemara says that a man who gets married, all the sins are forgiven. And the idea is that when a couple is married, they're basically losing their identity as being an individual and now creating a new identity as a married couple. And they're basically saying, yes, that person beforehand sinned, but that person doesn't exist anymore. I'm no longer just an individual, I'm now half of this team, half of this couple, which is a whole other entity altogether. And so it allows us to kind of go to Hashem and say, please forgive me for my sins. Now I'm a new person. So there are certain elements of Yom Kippur that we bring in to the wedding day. So one of them is fasting, and that's one of the reasons given as to why we fast. Another more practical reason given is so that they will not be drunk, because it's a festive day, it's a happy day, and the last thing we want is people who are drunk. The third floor, I'm sorry, yeah. The last thing we want is people being drunk at their own wedding, partly because it doesn't go very well, and also because we need intent that for the wedding to actually halachically work, we need him to willingly and knowingly say, you know, will you marry me? Please marry me with this ring. If he's drunk and he can't have intent, then we have a problem. Or if she doesn't have intent, and she doesn't know what she's doing, and she thinks she's marrying George Clooney, and then the next day, what happens here? So that's also a problem. So, for all parties involved, we don't want a drunk chassan or a kala. So that's another reason given as to, of course, all chassanim are George Clooney on their wedding day, as we all know. But that's another reason given. Now, some say that the chassidim Yishonim, the early chassidim, not chassidim as in like modern day chassidim living in, in Monroe, meaning chassidim like the righteous people of past generations, they would like to fast when they did a beloved mitzvah. So they would, you know, not eat before hearing shofar, not eat before benching lulav and etrog. So that was some ideas that part of it is with a beloved mitzvah you're supposed to fast, although most people don't usually quote that idea. Another reason given is that the Jews fasted when they received the Torah. And that was this life-changing experience when we kind of got married to Hashem. So too, when a couple gets married, just as when the Jewish people married Hashem, we fasted, so too when this couple gets married, we fast. That's another reason given as well. Like I said, this is only for Ashkenazim. Sephardim don't do this custom. We're more lenient on the kala. In general, it's a fast that we're pretty lenient on. So, if either person's not feeling very well, they're even somewhat sick, they don't fast well, then you can just skip it. It's not worth pushing or potentially ruining the day or not being able to show up to your own wedding because you wanted to fast. If you can fast normally, I mean, if you can fast on Shavuos or Tammuz or the 10th of Tevis and not think about it all that much, then fast. And it's a nice thing to be able to do so, but don't push it beyond, you know, what you'd have to do. And we tend to be more lenient with the kala as well. Some say because it tends to be harder for women to fast than men. Others say that women are less likely to get drunk than men, so we're less concerned about them. So, either way. Now, while it's a fast, it's a more lenient fast. So they can brush their teeth, and they can rinse their mouth out, and things that, you know, you would do on the more lenient fasts, you can do on this fast as well. It only starts the morning of, there's no fasting the night before, and so if they want to get up early and eat, they can definitely do that. And the fast goes up until the chuppah or until tzeis ha'kochavim. So if the chuppah is at night, then you only fast until tzeis, you know, until three stars are out, then you end your fast, even if the wedding hasn't started yet. You only fast till then. For spring and summer weddings, typically the chuppah happens before, say, certainly on a Sunday. So then you fast until the chuppah. Once you're in the chuppah, you're drinking wine. So at that point, you broke your fast. What? And now you're drunk because you're drinking wine on an empty stomach. So don't drink too much wine under the chuppah. Take a sip. Don't go crazy. That's not your time to really break your fast.
So the cup under the chuppah should be small.
The cup can be big. Just don't drink too much of it. Yeah. Don't go crazy with it. Yeah, if you're just, you know, downing it, don't do that.
Can you sip? Take little sips of water?
Yes, for sure. Yeah. You can. We're very. If you feel faint, just break your fast. Just break it. Don't play. Don't even play games with it. It's not worth it. If you feel somewhat faint, break the fast. It's, you know, call it a day. Now there are many days we don't fast. Like I said, we're very lenient here, so. Certainly any day that's somewhat of a holiday, you know, even Tu B'Av, Lag B'Omer, Rosh Chodesh, Purim, Shushan Purim, all those days, you don't fast. there are some of the customs, even days when we don't say Tachanun, it's like the entire month of Nisan, we don't say Tachanun. The entire month of Tishrei, we don't say Tachanun, you don't have to fast. That's a little lenient, but there are some opinions that say you can even go that far with it. Okay, so that's fasting. Not seeing each other the week before. So that really, you know, that's the thing. Yes, that's kind of harder and harder for people. It's interesting, you know. When I get married so many years ago in 2001, it seems like it was easier for people not to see each other. You know, now it's like, well, we've got the rehearsal dinner, we've got this thing together, and the families are together, and we text 85 times a day anyway. How, you know, like, so first you can talk and communicate to each other, you know, during that week. It's not that you can't talk, you're not supposed to see each other. You can text, and you can do whatever. Now, Skyping, you know, I don't know. Does that count? Am I really seeing them? I'm seeing a digital image of them. I'm not FaceTime. I don't know. Yeah, whatever. Could you if you want to? Is it really? So look, it's a custom. It's a nice custom. Again, it's not the be-all and end-all. It's not the end of the world if you have to see each other. It's not worth shalom bias. Put it that way. However, if you can do it, it's a nice custom. It definitely builds anticipation. It definitely helps prevent, you know, at times, look, people get very tense before the wedding. You're nervous. You've got a lot going on in your head. There's a lot going on. Sometimes it's good for the couple to be apart so they don't fight too much that week before, because that could happen too. However, sometimes that means you're fighting with other people and your friends and your family. So you want to call each other so this way you can vent about the fights you're having with other people. So it's good to talk, but it's good to have a little time apart as well. So everyone kind of finds their balance. Now, how, you know, that plays out with when you take your picture. So some people don't want to take their pictures before the wedding, so they don't see each other before the wedding, especially in the wedding dress and everything. But that means you have to take the pictures after the chuppah, which is doable, and we did that. It's a bit of a pain, and you're asking people to stick around for a long time, but if you have an open bar, nobody cares. You have a salad and some, you know, people are usually okay. But you have to rush. It's a bit of a hassle. And, you know, inevitably, you know, you tell everyone in the family, stay behind after the chuppah for pictures. And of course, you know, Uncle Harold is off who knows where. And Aunt Rose, we can't find her. And I told her to stay. And where did she disappear to? And
you did say there was an open bar.
Well, and there's an open bar. So, you know, it's doable, but you have to kind of really, you need people in charge of corralling people if you're doing it after the chuppah, because since the couple goes to the yichud room and then back to the chuppah, you've got a good 10 to 15 minutes before you can even start the pictures, and you get everyone together, and there's kids and whatever, it's complicated. So, there's pros and cons to both. Some people like to do the pictures before. It definitely takes away some of the, you know, mystique of the day. It doesn't matter either way. Everyone can make the decision that's best for them. Okay. The marriage license, everyone will figure out, you know, based on what state you're getting married and how to take care of that. That I don't have to tell you about. I will say this. I think Josh Goldberg mentioned this a few weeks ago. Send in the marriage license right away. I actually usually do it for the couple. Sometimes the rabbi does it. I actually usually do it because I feel like they've got so much on their heads they're going to forget. So I just, the next day I send it off, and this way they don't have to worry about it. It's one less thing for them to worry about. You know.
We're done.
If you're done, it's even better. So, but sometimes, often they're not done. So, one less thing to worry about is always a good thing. So if you can do it in advance, even better. So, let's start off with the chazan's tish and the Kabbalah's Panim. So, for the woman, it's pretty simple. She is, you know, typically the bride is greeting people. She's sitting on a chair, kind of like a throne, and she's greeting people. They're coming up to her. Everyone's telling her how beautiful she is, and she thanks them for coming. She watches everybody else eat, and she eats nothing, and just sits there looking at all the food that they're paying for, yet not eating. But that's a wedding. The chazan's tish is a little different. The chazan's tish is, there's a lot going on, a lot that has to be accomplished in the chazan's tish. So one thing is, depending on what time, Depending on what time the wedding is, they often will daven at the chasm. They shouldn't daven mincha. And you should remember that you're doing the davening of Erev Yom Kippur. Okay? So you're adding in vidui and all of that. Since it's a personal Yom Kippur, just the chasm and kala should daven the mincha of Erev Yom Kippur. Okay? Usually the chasm davens with a minion at the chasm tish. The kala should try to daven beforehand, if she can, you know, before. Yeah, really. Yeah, I think so. Because
is there a custom regarding who's the
Shaviyat Zibul about that? No, it can be anyone. Yeah.
Where do we find this?
Is it? Yeah, just if you have, so they do have, kind of masters for weddings, okay, which have a lot of this stuff, and it's good they have Tehillim to say before the wedding. So we. Yeah, it's really good. So just go to any Judaica store and say, like a sitter or a master specifically for a wedding, and they'll have the Sheva Brachas, and they'll have all the stuff in the marriage ceremony itself. So it's a good thing to have. I definitely recommend it. This way you don't have to go, and just keep it with you, and you'll be fine. And you know, ideally, the day of the wedding, there's a lot going on, and I always strongly recommend trying to find some quiet time during the day in advance. First, so you don't overly stress out. But you want to be able to enjoy the day. And it's a day of tefillah. It should be a day of davening as well. I mean, it's a day of reflection and in a spiritual day. And there's so much physicality to the wedding and the dress and the makeup and the tux and the food. And you're always involved in all these little details. And sometimes you lose the spirituality of the day. And if you can take some time to daven, to say Tehillim, whatever it is, whatever you need, it's just really important to give yourself a little time earlier in the day to kind of get your mind right and kind of inspire you so that the day is a spiritual day and not only wrapped up in all the physicality. And that, I think, kind of carries over later to the wedding itself.
Are we praying for other people? Or are we praying for the marriage?
Both.
Praying for?
Both.
Okay, our family?
Anybody you want. And it's definitely seen as an opportune day to daven for other people. You know, I think it's a really nice custom to daven for people that are looking for a shidduch on the day of your wedding. And this way, it's more of a selfless day. It's not all about you. It's not all about your experience. You're thinking of others, and certainly others who are in need. I think it's a really important thing to do. Some people even like take a list of names of them to the chuppah. And just kind of say those names in the chuppah and say, Hashem, please help these people find the shidduch. I think it's a really nice thing to do, and this way it just kind of takes, you know, it's a day about you enough. To be able to make sure you're thinking about others, I think is very important.
Is there also a special simplus to daven with the
sid? I mean, it's an opportune time to daven, for sure. And everyone, and everything is great, but I think certainly, you know, for someone else to find a shidduch is very... It's a really opportune time to do so.
Why is it that there always seems to be more stress on who the kala is praying for as opposed to the chatan?
Sexism. No, it shouldn't matter. No, there's no difference. No difference. Okay. So the chasen's tish. So we daven mincha and the chasen kala and the chasen will daven his own special tefillah. Take your time. Don't feel rushed, even though you'll take longer than everybody else because you were longer. Shimon Esrei than everybody else. Okay, now we sign two things, or we have the Tanayim and we have the Ksuba, which we take care of at the Chatzin's Tish. Now those who haven't done the marriage license do the marriage license then usually also before the wedding. It's also a really good time to have women, non-Jews, people sign the marriage license then. It's a good way to give them something to do, something that you couldn't give some of the Edim roles later on. Appointing and choosing Edim. So this is important.
So hold on.
Yes,
the marriage license, and there is the
Ketubah? The secular marriage license, I mean.
Oh, okay.
In America. I guess, I don't know how it works in Israel with, I guess the Ketubah is, I don't know how that works. That's what you sign. In America, you have to sign with the state your legal marriage license, then, so you're legally married by the state. So anyway, it's just like a, you know. So you have to figure out how to take care of that as part of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Appointing and choosing edim. You need four sets of edim at your wedding. So if you go to your handy dandy sheet that I've so kindly provided for you, you will see witnesses for tanayim, witnesses for ksuva, witnesses for license, that's just the marriage license. On the other side, witnesses for kiddushin, and witnesses for yichud. So four sets of edim. Now, they can be the same people, depending on how many potential edim you have at your wedding. All edim have to be Jewish, Shomer Shabbos, not related to you and not related to each other.
No family.
And we usually go even cousins. You know, a third cousin, whatever, fine, but no aunts and uncles, no grandparents, no first cousins, no brother-in-laws. We really are pretty machbit to try. We don't want anyone to ever be able to call the question the wedding after the fact. So it's more important. It's better to have the same two people be the edim throughout everything. And as long as they're the highest quality of edim for what you need, as opposed to, you know, doing something that could be potentially questionable down the road, and mixing it up and giving more people roles. So, now look, they don't have to be perfect, right? You don't say, well, I happen to know that 5 years ago this person did X, Y, and Z, you know, and they just spoke less than an hour 5 minutes ago. I'm going to make them an eight. So look, you know, as long as they're Shomer Shabbos and cautious publicly, and you know them generally to be a religious Jew, you know, you're fine. Again, you don't have to dig up Moshe Feinstein and make him your aide. You know, it's okay. You can work with what you've got as long as it's, you know, pretty reasonable. If you have a question, if you're unsure, so ask the rabbi. Ask the rabbis during the weddings. Like, here's the situation. This is their story. I've had weddings where, you know, I spoke to the couple in a week or two in advance and asked a few questions, and I couldn't use them as edim. And you know, it was hard for them, but they understood. I was at a wedding as a guest once, and they wanted to use someone as a witness who they've known for many years but didn't know so well. And I happened to know that they really weren't a kosher aid anymore, which very publicly they just weren't. So, you know, that was an awkward situation. That was not easy. Yeah, that's mine. It's not a sin to be divorced. Okay. Okay, so that's the edim. Now, so the first set of edim are for the tanayim. So the tanayim are what's it called? It's like the terms of the agreement. What does this mean? It's really a relic from the past. And I have a copy of the Tanayim here. Hebrew on one side and English on the other side. Okay. Now, what the Tanayim are, it used to be that when a couple got engaged, they really got engaged, and both sides of the family kind of got together and made the arrangements, right? The bride side will give, you know, three cows and two goats, and the groom side will give a wagon and Shabbos food for a year, whatever it was. So they really made like a financial agreement that was binding, and if either side broke it, there were serious ramifications to breaking it. And they did that well in advance of the wedding. This stopped being done for a long time. But we still have these tonight, and the tonight means like the terms of the deal, means the terms the families signed off on. So nowadays we do it really as a way for the families to show that they are blessing this marriage, they're happy about this marriage. There's a chance for the fathers and the mothers to kind of come together in unison and say that we support this marriage. So, they make this agreement, and we use something throughout the marriage called the Kinyan Sudar, or Chalipin. So Kinyan Sudar, I'm sure you've seen this at weddings, the rabbi says, pick up this pen, or pick up this handkerchief, and with that you're making a Kinyan. So there's a lot of different types of Kinyanim, a lot of different ways to facilitate a transaction in halacha. One of them It's based on the story of Ruth. I mean, that's where it comes from, that Boaz does this. It's just a physical manifestation to an intent. So they state the intent. They basically ask, do you agree with what's written on this document? They lift something up given to them by the rabbi, stating that they do. And then the two witnesses sign on the document saying that they have agreed. That the fathers are not really agreeing to anything specific. As you see from the document, it's very vague in general. That's when the mothers come in and break the plate. Again, since the father signs something, now the two mothers come in, it's really a chance for the families to show that they support this marriage. And they break the plate. The answer that most often given is that just as once a plate's been broken, it can't be put back together, so too once the agreement's been made, there's no going back, and that was a big part of the Tanayim that they didn't want to break. Yeah?
So my parents have both passed away, so
okay. You can have someone else do it. You can have a brother, a grandfather, an uncle. You can have someone else do it for you.
Does it have to be male, or
can it be female? For the Tanayim, it has to be male. Yeah. You can have someone else. You can appoint someone else to do it for you. Mm-hmm. And same too for the women. Yeah. Sister-in-law. What? The Tanayim? It's more custom. It's more custom. But I've never seen... We kind of try to have a role for the women and a role for the men in this regard. Yes, there are plenty of people that just say, you know what? I mean, it's not obligated. There's definitely no halachic ramifications to not doing it. And I've seen couples not do it altogether. It's a nice thing, but it's not a make or break in any way. Okay. Then we have the ksuba. So the ksuba, hopefully they've picked out by then, and they've checked it off with the rabbi doing the wedding, and it's been signed off on. So the ketubah is not signed by the chassan. Most people assume the chassan signs the ketubah. He doesn't sign it. It's the same process. He reads it. He's asked publicly, does he agree to the terms? Now, here there really are terms and legal ramifications to it. And you should all kind of read through a ketubah in advance to make sure you understand what it is. Basically, the husband providing for his wife and how he provided for her in case he wanted to divorce her, but he's obligated to her in marriage. Again, he's asked to lift something up, a pen or a handkerchief, to agree to the terms. Then the two Adam sign the document. And then the ketubah is transferred to the chuppah. Now, this is a good kind of segue into something that kind of permeates the entire wedding. Having what's called in halacha the shushpinin, but the helpers, a shliach of sorts. That, first of all, the chasen kala shouldn't really be alone the day of their wedding. And each of them should have someone with them. Could be a family member, could be a friend, whoever, to kind of be there with them and to help them out. And the day of your wedding, especially, you need a right-hand man, a right-hand woman. Could be your maid of honor or your best man, but it doesn't have to be. And there's a lot of things that happen throughout the wedding and in advance that you want someone to help you with. Something you want to go for. Hey, can you get me something? We didn't talk about this yet, but I'll talk about it now. There's a custom, for example, for the chassan to go to the mikveh the morning of the wedding. So often he'll go with him and he'll just kind of make sure that everything's running smoothly so he's not alone and so if he needs some help. But throughout the day of the wedding, you often need someone. Can you look into this? Can you check into this? Can you help me with this? It's good to have someone. And there's a halachic aspect of it as well, that since the chassan kala also, which will get into a tree like a king and a queen, a king and queen always have someone there to help them. They're never just alone by themselves. So that's also part of it, that the chassan kala should be treated as a king and a queen. They should have someone there to help them.
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah.
We're going to hire a wedding coordinator for the day.
Okay.
But now they're saying that the bride can set their own. Like,
the wedding coordinator is fine. Great. They're looking after everything. That's their personal person to help out. It could be, can you get me a drink? It could be, can you go tell the wedding coordinator something? Can you go check on something?
Okay.
Meaning they're not planning the event, but like some, yeah. So sometimes the wedding coordinator will take the ksuba from, you know, that ksuba gets moved around a lot. You sign the chasen, it goes to the chuppah, and the chuppah is going to end up back with them at the end of the wedding somehow. Sometimes people display it, you know, during the wedding. You don't want to lose it. You don't want to disappear. You want to make sure. So it's good to have someone in charge. So sometimes they'll say, you know what? you're my right-hand man, my right-hand woman. Your job is just keep an eye on the ketubah, make sure it ends up in my hotel room or in wherever it's supposed to end up in this room in the end. It's good to have someone who can kind of lean on throughout the night, throughout the day, and throughout the night. Okay, so the ketubah signed. Then we go to the bedekin. I'll try to speed up a little bit. So the bedekin is where they see each other for the first time at the wedding itself. He is escorted to where she is. And that's where he lifts up the veil. So why does he lift up the veil? So the most common reason you'll hear is just like Yaakov was, you know, tricked into marrying the wrong woman, he wants to make sure it's the right woman. The truth is, though, it doesn't fully make sense because it's not like her veil is down, he lifts it up. Her veil is, you know, that's why he maybe check on her, but why close the veil? So that's one reason given. Others compare it to Rivka and Yitzchak, that Rivka, when she first sees Yitzchak, out of modesty, she covers herself when she sees him. So some say we're also kind of bring back really the first marriage as Jews with Rivka and Yitzchak, because Avraham and Sarah met before they really were Jewish. I like this answer. This was a nice answer. Was the Ramah says that she wants to show that she's not looking for the ring. that she's not marrying him for his money. So she covers it, meaning, I don't care what you have, I don't care what you're wearing, I don't care what the ring looks like, I'm marrying you for you. So that's why he covers her, to send that message. I thought that was nice, I like that one. Now, not every community has the custom to do this. Again, Sephardim don't often do this. Other communities had, not that the Chassan lifted the veil and covered it. Sometimes her parents did it, sometimes the rabbi did it, sometimes these helpers did it. So there were different minhagim. It's pretty customary now that the chassan does it, but there were many minhagim throughout history as to who would actually do that job. And now there's been a custom for many years to for the fathers and sometimes the mothers to say a bracha to the bride as well, which should be in the siddur for the wedding. Okay, there's some customs. Some of the customs to throw seeds or like wheat kernels at the chassan and kal, either then or before they walk down. That's based on pruervu, like seeds for pruervu. They should be fruitful and multiply. So some communities had that custom. There's a custom to put ashes on the chassan's head, like on his forehead where he was just filling before he walks down the chuppah. That's one of the things we do, zecher l'churban, to kind of remember Yerushalayim. Okay. I didn't mention this. Yeah, at the chazan's tish, when you do the tanaim, there is a custom for someone to read the tanaim out loud as well. So I forgot to mention that. That is something to do. Okay, make sure I'm not missing anything. Okay. All right, the ksuba. I'll say the chuppah. Now, there's a lot of different customs. Who walks down who? Some customs have two fathers walking down the groom, two mothers walking down the kala. Some have the parents walking down, or grandparents. Everyone should be walked down by somebody. So if your parents have passed away, it's good to have someone take that role, walk down with you. It can be anybody you choose, but it's nice that you shouldn't walk down by yourself again, because a king and a queen will be escorted. They wouldn't walk by themselves. As far as what music you walk down to, what the procession is like, who's in the bridal party, that's all up to you. That's all personal choice. Okay, some people have the custom to hold candles when they walk down the aisle. The parents hold candles. So a few different reasons given for it. That just like a candle, you can pass the light from wick to wick without losing anything. So too, it's like the parents are saying to the children, we're passing down. It's like a passing of generations, one wick to the next. Some say it represents the light of Torah. Some say it's very practical. They used to do chuppahs at night, and they needed light, so people would carry candles up, so they had a light under the chuppah so they could see. So, it's again, here, there, if you want to do it, that's fine. Okay, now under the chuppah, there's a custom for the chassan to wear a kittel. So this is another thing that we're doing in honor of, that's like their personal Yom Kippur. That's part of the reason why the chassan goes to the mikvah before, like he goes to the mikvah Erev Yom Kippur. We talked about fasting. This is as well. Again, it's not a make or break thing, but many Sunni Ashkenazim have the custom He usually puts it on under the chuppah. He doesn't wear it usually as he walks down. It's usually waiting for him under the chuppah, and then he puts it on. Okay. There's a nice custom that I did, and I suggest, is that usually the chassan's is under the chuppah first. When the bride's coming towards him, instead of him waiting in the chuppah for him to come, he should kind of come out, leave the chuppah, and escort her in, kind of welcome her in. So it's not just like, hey, I'm waiting for you, come on, hurry up already. I think it's a nice thing to do. Certainly if there's steps, he walks down, walks up the steps. I think it's a nice thing to do. Okay. So then she walks around him. The Ashkenazi custom is 7 times. So Ashkenazi, some had 3 times, but now it's pretty prevalent for her to walk around him 7 times. So why 7 times? So a few different reasons given. One is that it represents the 7 heavens, the kind of 7 spiritual, the 7 like levels of Shemayim. Some say it represents the Yom Kippur Avoda. There's the Achas, 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 the 7 different parts of the Yom Kippur Avoda. Again, back to Yom Kippur. I like to say that it represents just like the 7 days of the week for the completion of the world. On the 7th day, the world was complete. So too, the couple is saying that we were incomplete and now we're fully complete because we found each other. That she completes him. That sounds nice. I like to say that. Okay. Okay. So she walks around him 7 times and then they stand in place. You work out the Masada Kedusha and how everyone's standing. I personally, when I do a wedding, I like to have a couple face the audience and not have their backs face the audience because I think it's nice for them to see for you to see each other. So your back is to the audience. It's like, I don't know, it just seems kind of impersonal. You're staring at someone's back the whole time. But some people prefer that, and some people don't want to see the crowd. They don't want people to see their emotions or their reactions, so they like to look away. So when I do a wedding, I usually have the couple facing the audience, but nothing halachic about that, just my preferences. So I'm going to kind of add in some of these things as well. If you're looking at everyone. Yeah, it's nice. You want to share the experience together. If you're seeing it back, what are you seeing? So, and like the rabbi can stand off to the side. You know, what I do is I have a couple facing the audience. I stand to the side. You can pivot both ways. You know, you don't need like the rabbi faces the audience. A couple faces him. It's easily manageable. Try not to have your chuppah too packed with people. You know, it's okay to have close family members, parents. You don't need like everyone in your family to be lining the chuppah where like it gets, you know, a bit crowding. You know, I've been to chuppahs and people like elbowing each other for room. Yeah. What do you mean? She runs up to the chuppah?
My sister has little children and they're going to walk and they're going to want to be like with mommy.
And she's going to be up there? Make sure that works. You know, if it's not going to work, maybe she shouldn't be up there if it's going to be too difficult. Or you just be ready to roll with the punches and just kind of deal with it because that's what's going to happen. You know. However you want to handle it, you know, it's just, you run that risk. So it's nice to have people into the chuppah. Again, it's a nice thing for their family to be there, but they don't have to be there and, you know, you don't have to make it crazy either. Okay, so she walks around 7 times. That's usually when the rabbi speaks. The chassan and kala are incredible people. The families are incredible. And amazingly, it connects perfectly to that week's parsha. That's the rabbi's job, right? Okay, the first thing you do under the chuppah is the first cup of wine. You have 2 cups of wine. Usually, if you're providing the wine, make sure it's white wine. In case it spills, you don't want red wine on a white dress. Make sure you have white wine. The caterers all know this, the wedding halls know this, but it's something to look into it to make sure you want it to be white wine. You can bring your own Kiddush cups. It's nice to bring your own Kiddush cups to make sure this, you know, there's usually some personal meaning to it. So the rabbi will say the first bracha. It's a bracha we say only under the chuppah. It's a bracha for the wedding. It's like the bracha for the mitzvah of getting married. He says the bracha. Usually he'll spill a little bit of the wine on his own finger to drink some of it without drinking from the cup because that would be a little gross. So since he's saying Bray Priya Gafin, he's the one to drink. So usually, if you notice, he'll spill a little bit on his finger just so he drinks some of it as well. But really, it's for the chasan kal to drink. They each take a sip. Like I said, if you're fasting, don't drink too much. If you're not fasting, go crazy. So after that, you have the ring ceremony. That's when we typically call up witnesses. Now we have really probably the most important witnesses of the night. These are two witnesses who are going to witness the kiddush and the ring ceremony. They're called up. Often the rabbi will show them the ring, make sure that the ring you have is of some precious metal, but has no inscriptions, no gemstones, just plain. They have this ring, and the chasan takes out the ring and just shows it to the witnesses. They're asked if they own this ring. It's important that the chasan owns the ring himself. He buys it himself. He acquires it himself. If you're using someone else's ring or your great-grandmother's ring, whatever, make sure you fully own it and you're going to give it to her. You really should give her a ring she's going to keep, not one that she has to then give to somebody else afterwards and then get a replica instead. There's some sentimental value, but make sure it should really be the ring she's going to keep. Okay. So he takes out the ring, he holds it, shows it to witnesses, and then says, Harayah Mekadesh Likadah Moshe V'Yisrael, that he says, but this ring, we'll wed through the customs of Moshe in Israel. She takes out her right index finger, her strongest hand and her strongest finger. He puts it on the finger. She shows it to the witnesses. They say, Mekudesh and Mekudeshet, that she's taking possession of it. And then she puts it on her ring finger and doesn't worry about it for the rest of her life. Hopefully. Okay. Then the witnesses go back, and Gamar knew that at that point, they are pretty much married. They've gone through the first part of what the marriage process, which is called Kiddushin, which is the betrothal. Then we bring out the ketubah. Someone reads the ketubah. That's a hard job. Give it to someone who's done it before or really knows what they're doing. To get in front of a lot of people and start reading Aramaic is very intimidating if that's not something you've done before. So make sure you have someone who really knows what they're doing. They read the ketubah. He takes it and then he gives it to her under the chuppah. And then she gives it to someone again. Make sure you have someone to give it to under the chuppah. Then you do the shevar bracha. With a second cup of wine, that can be anybody. The custom is for it to be Jews who are male Jews. We're a little more lenient about the Shomer Shabbos rules. You don't want like a real apikoros up there, but Uncle So and So or whoever who's a good Jew and does a lot of mitzvot, but maybe isn't fully Shomer everything. So then we can be a little bit more lenient when it comes to that. Ideally, everyone is fully Shomer Shabbos, but the reality is that doesn't always happen, and certainly with families. So that can be anyone. It can be family, it can be friends. There's no requirements that it's they can be related. Okay. So after the seventh bracha, they each take a sip of that. Then they break the glass. Make sure the glass is easily breakable, just like earlier the plate is easily breakable. And everyone says mazal tov, they go off to the yichud room. So the yichud room is the place where they go for the first 8 to 10 minutes or so after the wedding. There's two reasons we do it. Well, more than that, but two reasons I like to say. Number one, there's a halachic aspect to it. That the couple is not officially married until they live together. They're together. Meaning, they're together in the home together. So we look at the chuppah as being a home to a certain extent as well. So typically we say that they're together in the chuppah, that's like their first home. However, according to the Rambam, they really have to be together in isolation. So we want them to be in isolation so that they're fully married right afterwards. This way we kind of end any doubt that they're not fully married. There's another good side to it, and that is, you spend the whole wedding with other people. You barely see each other at your own wedding. So it's good, your first moments married, you take good 8 to 10 minutes to be together, you're by yourself. Sometimes you give each other gifts. Sometimes, you prepare long poems for each other, whatever it is, whatever your style is. And if you're fasting, that's often when you eat and drink. And tell the caterer, make sure, have some Gatorade and some, mini hot dogs for you waiting, because that's a good time. Because again, you're going from that to dancing, and then you're not going to eat very much. eat and drink then, and it'll help you later on, because we've all heard stories of brides and grooms who have fainted at their own weddings, and it's not good. Now, I've been to two weddings where someone has fainted under the chuppah. So, always remember, typically a chuppah is really somewhat dangerous, because people usually aren't drinking very much. They're wearing usually a lot of heavy clothes. There's usually bright lights focused on them. They're standing for long periods of time. I've been in a two chuppah, someone's passed out. Literally passed out under the chuppah. You don't want that. So, make sure, hopefully if you can remind people to drink, you don't want to deal with that. If the chuppah goes too long, you're also more susceptible to that as well. So, just be aware. Okay. Now, we need witnesses for the yichud as well. The witnesses for the yichud, the role they play, number one, is they make sure that there's nobody in that room. They usually go into the room before the chasen kol do, make sure nobody's there, and make sure there's no entrance either, you know, in and out, and then really the door should be locked, and then they kind of stand guard in front, make sure nobody comes in so the couple has their privacy. You should be in the yichud room 8 to 10 minutes, and then from a halachic perspective, that's pretty much it. Any questions? And all that. Oh no, I'm not gonna. Oh, you're trying to get me in trouble here?
Yeah. Which is the bracha of all the singing?
What?
Which is the bracha of all the singing?
I'm sorry?
The bracha
from the. Oh, which? The sixth one. I'm sorry. It's the seventh one under the chuppah, because we start with Bar Pri Hagafen. So it's the seventh one.
That's so. The one where you want the guy to have a good voice.
The guy with the good voice, give the seventh one. Right. Now, as far as kind of the order of what's the higher kibbutim, the lower kibbutim, you know, it's not 100% cut and dry. We typically say the highest kibbut after the Masada Kedushin is the one who reads the ketubah under the chuppah. Then the Sheva Bracha, they're also a kibbut as well. The Sheva Bracha?
Yeah.
That's not our custom. If you specifically want ways to include women into the wedding ceremony, I'm happy to discuss it with you offline, and we'll discuss some ideas. You know, if that I've seen or used in the past. There's ways of being creative, and ways that it's not halachically a problem. There's definitely ways of doing so. A wedding, there's a lot of room for creativity and individuality within halacha. So, you know, you can definitely find something if it's necessary. Luckily, every Jewish wedding has about 30 doctors there. So, usually they get good treatment right away. Both times I had that, it was pretty quick. You know, they came to, they gave them some water, they sat them down, and things, you know, went pretty quickly. One, it was because the chuppah went on forever. It wasn't my fault. It was... They had a friend who was like a real Karbach guitar player, and he played like 4 songs under the chuppah, and he wrote a song for them, and like it took an hour, and and this guy passed out. The other one, I think they just hadn't drank enough, and that was it, and they just passed out. It wasn't because of, you know, the emotion of the day. I didn't have nothing like that. There's a lot of physical demands, and the chasen kol have to be aware of it too, because for them, there's definitely some concern that if they're not eating and drinking, that they don't want to pass out either.
How long is the average class?
I think you should take 30 to 40 minutes total. I think 40 minutes from the first person walking down till the couple being escorted out, which should be about 40 minutes. Depends on how much you slip it out, depends how long people, you know, there's some, it shouldn't take more than that. You know, as long as the rabbi speaks. Right, so and he does that usually right after she walks around 7 times before he makes the first bracha. You have 2 rabbis speaking? So forget it. You got a longer chuppah than at that point. I can't speak to that. You know, you can try to give a rabbi, you know, please try to speak to 5 minutes. I'll say this: assume they're going to speak over the time you give them. So. If you want 5, tell them 3. If you want 7, tell them 5, you know. And then hopefully you'll get there. I've been to chuppahs not, you know, where the rabbi's gone for 30 minutes and it's just ridiculous. But most rabbis know that They shouldn't be there to... They're there to enhance it, not to steal the show. So hopefully the rabbis will be good at that. Okay. Any other questions? All right.